Good morning, everyone. Welcome. Our first case this morning is United States v. Amir Husseini, case number 08-1879 and 08-1880. Mr. Ackerman?
Please, the court. Counsel for the government. Alan Ackerman, appearing for Mr. Obai in the joint appeal. Mr. Obai and Mr. Husseini maintain, in large part, that reversal is warranted because of the flawed jury selection in this case. The defendants argue, and we think with some substantial support, that the district court clearly erred in failing to ask, at the request of defense counsel, on an individual basis, after two jurors excused themselves for prejudice, to simply ask jurors on an individual basis whether they can be fair to folks from Iran in this case. The district court rejected that notion at sidebar, saying, among other things, that he didn't want to lengthen the voir dire with those individual questions. Now, the court has asked, did the government file anything in their answering brief undermining the quartet of decisions that mandate, if you will, reversal because of the district court's error here? We do not take that position lightly. Questions of prejudice are never taken lightly. But in this particular case, in the context of the entire proceeding, the government insisted early on that part of their proof in this 100-count indictment, it was very important that they be able to tell the jury, as part of the indictment and evidence, that Mr. Husseini sent $100,000 by way of Canada, by way of somewhere else, to Iran. The government also wanted the district court to permit them to introduce FBI agents and during their testimony highlight the fact that they are part of anti-terrorism. So the picture, as a picture, is the government juxtaposing two Iranian Americans who were selling cars, and yes, they sold cars to people who sold dope, but they sold cars. That was their business. Separately, I might add, but that was their business. So when you put it in context, it is the defense position that based on Ristano, Gomez, Booker, and Robinson, both Seventh Circuit cases, that this court should, certainly I can't say the court must, but the court should grant trial anew.
The district court did ask a general question about ethnicity and racial bias during the general questions to the veneer, and so this is a more focused argument that individual voir dire should have proceeded from the responses of some of the jurors.
Correct. Okay. It was only after two jurors explained they could not be fair because the folks were from Iran that defense counsel specifically asked the court, take them individually, voir dire. We're trying to find out if there's any other people who will privately acknowledge those prejudices.
Does that distinction that I just raised take this case out of the line of precedence that you're referring to? Because the issue was addressed, it simply wasn't addressed in individual voir dire.
On the contrary,
and in the other cases, the issue was not addressed at all.
Judge Sykes, the law from this circuit and the law from Ristano is that where defense counsel, after the type of incidents that we are talking about, specifically asks the district court, then under the court's supervisory power, this is the Ristano footnote that we cite in our brief, and the two cases that follow from the Seventh Circuit, including Booker and Robinson, that the supervisory power of the court demand that in the federal case that trial anew ensue where the district court fails to ask.
So it's not a discretionary determination by the trial judge?
Not under the circumstances that are described in the Seventh Circuit precedent, nor the U.S. Supreme Court decision in Rustano.
How do we recognize that borderline that you're arguing for, when between situations in which the district court, here we have an experienced district judge, picked hundreds if not thousands of juries, who concluded that the best way to approach this difficult and important subject was through general questions. How do we tell, under your theory, when the judge no longer has discretion to handle it that way?
You're talking here about, and again, taking it in context. The U.S. and Iran were, according to President Bush, during the trial of this case, the functional equivalent of enemy combatants. When you take that as part of the mix here, and that is between Iraq, Iran, and Afghanistan, you had this vision of Muslims terrorists. And keep in mind that, as our brief shows, the government eventually declined to argue terrorism. They were going to keep, they wanted to keep it in. But they, and we have the specific transcript page numbers, where they said, okay, we will not bring into, we will not seek to introduce testimony about these factions that are part of terrorism. And this had to do with a 100-count indictment where one count had to do with only Mr. Husseini sending $100,000 through intermediaries to Iran. So now in the context of a 100-count indictment, how important could that have been if the government did not want to trade on this hostility?
I understand your point, but could you get back to my question about how we tell the difference as to when the line is crossed, under your theory, between when, those questions and the manner of questioning that is left to the discretion of the district judge, and those when you say, in our exercise of supervisory power, we should take away that discretion and require the individual questioning?
That's a very fair question, and I appreciate the question. The answer is that when you have composite circumstances where jurors frankly tell the court that because of the ethnic background, not the skin color,
not, would there not be the, a different rule for race?
Well,
a
not
different rule for gender?
Not according to our circuit. Our circuit, in the cases Booker and Robinson, both use supervisory power where defense counsel requested the district court to specifically ask about prejudice. The district court refused, and the convictions were vacated.
And in those cases, there was no question raised. The subject was not raised at all, correct?
Oh, no, there were. There were general questions concerning, it's either Booker or Robinson that Judge Stevens wrote, where the question that defense counsel proffered was, could you please ask the jurors whether any of them are specifically biased against black defendants?
No. I'm talking about the difference that Judge Sykes was raising between raising the question generally with jurors addressed to the entire panel versus what you're saying should be required, individual one-on-one questions to each juror.
Only when two facts occur. Jurors show that there is some question about fairness, and number two, when defense counsel specifically asks. Those are the two times.
Why, under your theory, should it be necessary to have some jurors volunteer a yes answer, in essence, in response to the general question before this duty is triggered?
That's another very fair question. I can only take the authority as I see it. And as I see it, you clearly need the second prong where defense counsel must ask the district court to make the query. As to the first, frankly, the Seventh Circuit cases that we've relied on, I know one of them did show some antecedent juror prejudice. The second, I don't recall. I prefer to remain to spend the balance of my time on rejoinder. The arguments that I've presented for Mr. Obai are laid out in the briefs, and with the court's permission, I'll rely on that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Martin.
May it please the court, Mark Martin, I represent Amir Husseini. The issue that I'd like to start off talking about, of course, is the proceeds issue, which is the first issue raised in the joint brief. The bookends of this federal money laundering prosecution are saturated with references to proceeds, the essential element of money laundering. The indictment was replete with references to proceeds in the RICO conspiracy count, the money laundering conspiracy count, and the substantive money laundering counts. The same is true of the jury instructions. Time and time again, the word proceeds is used, yet the jury is not told what the word means.
Did you ask the judge to define proceeds for the jury in the instructions?
No.
Did anybody?
No one. It's amazing to me. I was not the trial lawyer. I know that's no excuse, but neither the government, the defense, nor the district court.
So if it wasn't an issue at the trial, why should we dive into that?
Because it's an issue of what the government must prove. It's an essential element of the money laundering statute.
But, Mr. Martin, here these drug dealers, obvious drug dealers, showed up with bags and bags and bags of money. So couldn't it have just been understood by everybody in the room that those were drug proceeds?
Well, the requirement in this court's cases, in Shalaba, in Lee, Hodges, Malone, a long line of cases, is that the proceeds have to be proven to be net proceeds.
Those are promotions, money laundering cases, and not concealment or transactional avoidance money laundering cases. Why doesn't that distinction make a difference?
Well, if we start with the language of the statute, if you look at 1956, it starts with laying out the elements that apply to the various subcategories of the offense, and it uses the word proceeds twice. One, the transaction must be committed with proceeds of specified criminal activity, and two, there's a mens rea requirement associated with proceeds. And then it goes on to define how you can commit that crime, concealment, promotion, and avoidance. So when you start with the overall predicate that defines the subcategories, if you will, the proceeds applies equally. It's a question of how is this word defined. In Lee, the court noted that the distinction between concealment and promotion was one that I guess the government attempted to raise in that case, but it found that, and in fact, the proceeds requirement applies to concealment cases. That's from the structure of the statute.
Well, let me ask you, if we look at the Supreme Court's opinions in the Santos case, it seems to me that the opinion that's most favorable for your position is Justice Scalia's plurality opinion, right?
I agree.
And Justice Scalia says, in essence, it shouldn't be that hard to prove this. For example, someone accepting receipts from what he knows to be a long-continuing drug-dealing operation can be found to know that they include some profits. That suggests to me that that if the issue had actually been raised, it could have been addressed very easily here.
I understand the court's question, but there are two proceeds elements in the money laundering statute. And what Justice Scalia was addressing in that portion of the opinion was the mens rea requirement. And he goes on to talk about how an ostrich instruction might be appropriate in such cases. But there is the preceding proceeds element that the transaction has to be proved to be conducted with net proceeds, which is different from the knowledge requirement, and there's a distinction.
You need an accountant?
Do you need an accountant to...
For an accountant to review the drug operation in order to make this proof? Where well, you've got what Justice Scalia describes as a long continuing drug dealing operation, which presumably is profitable.
Part of the criticism of this court's approach in Scalabo was just that. With criminal operations, they don't exactly lend themselves to having accountants and books and things like that. But the court was faced with a difficult problem. How do we deal with the merger problem? And the way the court answered that, which I think is ingenious, is that, well, what's the word proceeds mean? And that's how they answered that question. And the merger problem applies in this case.
How does it apply in this case? We've got drug operations using these car dealerships to get rid of some of that cash. They've got to do something with it. What sort of merger issue do we have?
The merger issue or the concern over merger. First of all, let me preface it by saying it can arise both in promotion and concealment cases. The plurality opinion in Santos made that statement. But part of the concern with merger is one of sentencing, is that defendants who are here, they're in the business of selling cars, but they're punished with extreme money laundering sentences. And in this case, as a practical matter, Mr. Husseini's base offense level was set at 42 or 44, practically off the charts, based on the money laundering. So you're taking someone who's committing financial crimes, and you're punishing them as if they are committing the underlying criminal offense. And that's part of the merger problem. The second part of the merger problem is that should there be a distinction between the underlying transaction and the laundering transaction? That's one way the merger problem could have been dealt with, but there's not a majority of the justices on the Supreme Court that dealt with it that way. This court hasn't dealt with it that way. In the way that the courts have elected to deal with it is by taking this undefined word and defining it with net proceeds.
I don't understand your point with respect to merger, because in Santos, the point that this court and the Supreme Court's plurality made were that inherent in the gambling operation that was charged in that case, you would have the transactions occur that then gave rise to the money laundering charges and sentencing, inherent in the underlying crime. That argument doesn't apply at all to Mr. Husseini or Mr. Obey, who are charged with laundering, in essence, proceeds, call them net, call them gross, receipts, whichever, from the drug operations.
The merger, I think, has two concerns, as I just mentioned. One is a question of timing. Does the transaction have to be separate from the criminal offense producing the proceeds?
And clearly it does here. It is here, right?
Right. I mean, the defendants were not selling contraband. They were not selling, right. Or at least Mr. Husseini was not selling drugs. So that's concern number one, but concern number two goes to the sentencing element of elevating sentences for money laundering.
Well, that's Congress's and the Commission's choice, isn't it? They decided even if you don't participate in the underlying drug dealing, gambling operation, whatever, extortion rackets, whatever the predicate crimes may be, we're going to hit the bankers very hard.
So we go back to square one. What does the statute require? The statute requires at least two elements of proceeds. How is the word proceeds defined? And in this case, I think what I'm getting is, well, you can rely on speculation. Well, that was Justice Alito's criticism of the plurality's opinion in the case, that if we make this an essential element, that means it's the government's burden to prove proceeds. It would have been easy enough for the government to try and prove it, but they didn't do it in this case. It's not the defense burden. We didn't have the obligation to do anything. We were defending against a case that our position was the government could not prove it beyond a reasonable doubt. And one of the elements they have to prove is proceeds, and they have to prove it with net. And they didn't take that step, just like they didn't take the step in Malone, they didn't take the step in Shalaba, in the whole line of cases.
I don't think there's any dispute about what the evidence is here and that it wasn't, this issue wasn't covered as an evidentiary matter or an instructional matter. What we're talking about is whether the rationale for the Santos decision has any force here in the context of this prosecution, which is a concealment and transactional money laundering, not a promotion money laundering. There's no merger problem of the sort that my colleagues have described it, which is to say that the crimes are so overlapping and embedded within each other that proof of one constitutes proof of the other. We just don't have that problem here.
Well then the court would have to find that the word proceeds means something different for concealment. It means something different for...
Why is that not a good idea in this context?
First of all, as I said before, the structure of the statute doesn't allow it. The government even recognizes this is a peculiar way to analyze a statute. It cites no authority for its position.
There's Justice Stevens.
Justice Stevens' opinion, with all due respect, did not state that I am construing the word proceeds to mean something different for concealment and something different for proceeds. He looked at the specified criminal activity for that's what he looked to. He didn't look to the concealment and the promotion.
Well, he clearly left open the possibility that the statute might apply differently in different contexts or in the context of different crimes and different subsections of the statute.
Crimes, yes, that he did. And
that's the opinion we're supposed to be applying under the Marx rule, right?
Well, with the Marx rule, yes, that's the opinion supposed to be applying. Now, I would note that some of the cases the government cite from the other circuits say, well, because this is unclear to us, we have to go to pre-Santos precedent in this circuit. And if this court did that, then we get to Shalaba, we get to Malone, we get to Santos, the Seventh Circuit's decision in Santos. So what's good for the goose is good for the gander. And in fact, this court, in Lee and Hodges, applied the Shalaba rule to a brothel operation, which would be trafficking in contraband of a sort, and that was post-Santos. I see I'm into my rebuttal time, so I'd like to reserve the few moments I have. We do not by any means abandon any of our other issues. I think the evidentiary issue with respect to Mr. Husseini's attempt to introduce 8300 forms is an important issue. The court erred in finding that this evidence was not convincingly probative. It was probative. It directly refuted the indictment, and it handcuffed him in his ability to try this case. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Greenwald.
Good morning, Your Honors. I'm going to start with the proceeds issue that Mr. Martin just talked about. Essentially, defendants are arguing that their money laundering convictions rested on an erroneous interpretation of proceeds as meaning gross receipts as opposed to net profit. And the government's first position would be that is got to be reviewed under a plain error standard. It wasn't raised below in the jury instructions, and it wasn't raised below in terms of any motions for judgment of acquittal or otherwise, which were formed very particularly, and to the extent there was any general language, it was in the context of the law as it was there and the instructions as given, and that's how it was understood by the court and the parties. But even if you were to review this under a different standard, and the only reason I think the plain error review is important here for the court is under that review, what I think is absolutely positively clear here, and I'll get to it in a minute when I get to my merits, is that this is not obvious error. It is not obvious by any stretch of the imagination that that proceeds means net in the context of a concealment or avoidance case. So that's why I think that standard of review is particularly important here. But even if that is not the standard of review and you do reach the merits on the issue, not only is it not the law that net proceeds is the definition of proceeds for a concealment or avoidance prong case, it shouldn't be. And first of all, it is not the established law in this circuit, even absent Santos, that it applies in a concealment or avoidance case. All of this court's precedent is in the context of the promotion prong. And the language in Lee that Mr. Martin is relying on actually quotes, is actually relying from language in Santos. And if you go back to Santos at pages 892 to 893 of that opinion, it makes it clear that all they're saying in Santos about the concealment and the promotion prong is that this isn't a concealment case. The court goes on in saying, in mentioning concealment, Shalaba merely pointed out that concealment was not at issue and that the government's case rested solely on the disposition of gross income and whether such disposition was actionable under A1, which is promotion. B is concealment. Shalaba touched upon lack of concealment simply to show that to resolve the case, the court had no alternative but to interpret the words proceeds, which suggests that in a concealment case, there is case law, which this court is very cognizant of, where the meaning of concealment is much more limited. It's the whole, this whole court's interpretation of concealment has been to avoid the merger problem. So I go through that at length just to point out there is no precedent in this circuit to say that proceeds means net in the context of concealment or avoidance. And in fact, in Hodge, this court, in analyzing post-Santos, post-Justice Stevens's and the plurality's decisions, actually does a whole analysis of whether advertising costs should be treated as net or gross for the meaning of proceeds using Justice Stevens' rationale, which Mr. Martin just conceded before this court is, under Marx, the appropriate interpretation of the meaning of Santos. So I think under neither this court's decision nor under Santos is there any precedent saying this is an established matter that proceeds means net. Nor should it be for the reasons that this court indicated in its questioning of Mr. Martin. I mean, essentially, this is not a merger case.
Ms. Greenwald, let me ask you about the standard of review here.
Yes, Your Honor.
As I understand it, the defendant's Rule 29 motions were identified some relatively specific points, not including the net proceeds versus gross proceeds.
Correct.
If they had just been general, if those motions had just said, the government has failed to prove all the elements of all 100 counts or any of the 100 counts beyond a reasonable doubt, would that have been enough to preserve the issue?
I don't think so. I don't think so because if the point of Rule 29 is to put the parties and the court on notice, then that's got to be interpreted, like a general motion like that, must be interpreted, I believe, to be you have not met your burden, because the government certainly has the burden to prove this.
But a general motion under that approach then is useless.
It doesn't define the legal issue. In a case like this, where I'm not saying that it wouldn't, because there is some case law that suggests that mm-hmm. is enough, and I don't mean to suggest that it can't be enough. In a case where everybody's agreed and the jury instructions have defined proceeds as meaning a certain thing. But when you're arguing on appeal that the legal meaning of something is different than everybody understood it at trial and instructed the jury at trial, then I think really what you're dealing with here is a jury instruction issue. It's a legal issue. It's not just a sufficiency of evidence. In other words, obviously the government, by making a blanket motion like that, then I think the government is certainly put on notice and the court is put on notice. Did you prove your elements, looking at the evidence under the understanding of the law as instructed to the jury?
An instructional error has to be specifically preserved.
Yes. I think in this context of this kind of a case, and if you look at most of the case law, because believe me, I did, in trying to deal with just this issue you're identifying, it's very hard to find a case that isn't also in the context of an instructional error. But I do not mean to suggest, by answering that way, Your Honor, or to represent to the court, that there is not case law as a general matter suggesting that a general motion like that can preserve specific sufficiency arguments.
Would you agree, though, that there's nothing in the text of Rule 29 that requires a court to give, let's say, preservative power to an unspecific general motion?
There's nothing one way or another.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. In the history of that, I mean, when you really dig into it a lot of that language about the general power to preserve is stemming from cases that go to venue. and whether when you make a general motion like that, it's preserving a venue argument. A lot of it goes into those kind of historical roots when I started researching it, in the Jones case that's cited in there. And some of that has been reversed over time. But rather than get you bogged down in that, I just thought basically our position here is that this really is a jurisdictional, I mean, jury instruction question. It's a legal issue. And also, I think, again, getting back to the point of Rule 29, I mean, the government did have evidence. I think we point this out in a footnote of our brief. You know, certainly, I can't say what witnesses would have testified if they had been asked about NET, but I do know this one parade of gang members and things. I think there would have been a good argument to have gotten that evidence in if we wanted to hedge our bets under a net proceeds kind of theory. And there's other things that we could have raised had this issue been raised at trial. But getting back to the merits of the rule, the government would urge that the rule, that this whole interpretation of net profits does not apply in concealment and avoidance. And if you step back, and just look at this case, it is a classic money laundering case. It is a classic case where whether these drug dealing funds be profits or net or whatever, they are hiding that money in these cars.
If we don't buy your argument, Your Honor. On the proceeds issue, does that necessarily undo both of these sentences?
I think that Mr. Martin's point in response to your question about whether our evidence was sufficient just in general on this, I mean, we do concede in our brief. And it's as Mr. Martin explained, not on the intent issue, but as we read these cases, if you were to find net, it means it actually has to have been net, not just that the defendants perceived that they were getting net or getting proceeds, but that they actually were. And as to the substantive counts, there were either the wrinkle in this case, as opposed to the general cases being described in the Supreme Court opinion you were quoting, is that what they're buying here are cars. And so the defense does have the argument that cars are used to distribute drugs. I mean, they do. They do have that argument. However, it doesn't end there. And because of the evidence that we point out in our brief that shows that, you know, people were buying it for personal use, they were, you know, adding personal improvements to them, and all of that, certainly under a plain error standard, but even under a sufficiency standard, goes to the government. But on the certain substantive counts, and there were like four or five, you know, exact number, we do not believe could be sustained under a net, only because we didn't have either the witnesses didn't testify, or if they did testify, the evidence was pretty strong that it was for their own use. However, the government's strongly held position is that does not affect the money laundering conspiracy charge for which we had this other evidence. And it absolutely, positively does not affect the RICO conspiracy charge on which we rely on a case decided by the defense, Genova. This is exactly Genova, where you had multiple racketeering acts. Remember, we had most of the charges in this case were the structuring accounts, because all this money that came in from these drug dealers buying cars was structured into the bank deposits to the tune of millions and millions of dollars. Well, those didn't have to be proceeds. But our whole theory of the case, that this was drug money and they were assisting drug dealers in laundering their money, that all went to the structuring because it explains why they were structuring it. They were structuring it to hide this money for the drug dealers. If they went and started reporting all these funds to the government could track down the drug money. So the structuring charges are still there. There are so many of them. The mail fraud is still there. The bribery is still there. And it's all hung together. And we have a special verdict. So this is just like the case Genova, where the bribery, there were multiple predicate acts, bribery and mail fraud, I believe, in that case. The bribery were no longer good, but this court said the mail fraud, there are multiple acts, they handled over a period of time, we had a special verdict, your RICO count stands. That's still not to answer your question, Your Honor, about sentencing, but I do think that there would need to be a resentencing. That's my long way of getting to that. But yes, there would, simply because you know, to be sure that Judge Shader, he sentenced basically largely on the statutory maximum, at least for Mr. Husseini, and certainly took into account that these were money launderers as well as structurers and everything like that. I, you know, the government would obviously argue for the same sentence, but I do think it would need to be resentenced under Black just to ensure that. I think that covered all my points on that, unless the court has any questions on that matter. Then I'll move to the jury and the jury questioning. So first off, factually, the judge did ask of the entire veneer and asked individually of the entire veneer whether they had any cause for concerns or couldn't be a fair to Iranian Americans.
What do you mean he asked individually?
Well, I would say individually because it's not like he just asked, you know, as a general thing and then didn't expect each juror to notify him. In other words, he specifically instructed the jury, both the ones in the box and the one in, ones in, out in sitting out there, that I'm going to ask you these questions. In, you know, I'm asking each of you these questions, but I'm not going to repeat them each time you're up here. So if you have an answer to one of my questions, I want you to write it down. And when it's your turn in the box, I'm going to ask you, did you have? So, you know, short of having to repeat it each time, and that wouldn't even be enough for the defense. What they want is repeat it each time at sidebar. And what Judge Shader said in his discretion was the comments by these witnesses, and he's actually taken aback by this whole thing when it comes up because and I think that's reflected on the record because he knows this was just said at sidebar. It was not said in front of the entire veneer. He asked, and I think the defense counsel asked each of these veneer members, had you discussed this with anyone on the veneer? No. Surely they were responding to this question, is there a reason you can't be fair? They were. But the specifics of what they said was all said at sidebar.
The topic of race and ethnic bias was raised more specifically than the generic, is there any reason you can't be fair? I mean,
it was specific. It wasn't just can't be fair. It was can't be fair to these defendants who are Iranian Americans. I mean, it was very specifically.
Was there a written questionnaire they filled out asking?
I don't think so. I think it was done orally at the, you know, at the veneer. But, you know, Judge Shader was very thorough in it. And the cases cited by the defense lawyer are cases where you have to ask the question. That's what they say. You cannot not ask in a case like this. The government's not saying. We'd be in a very different posture if Judge Shader said, I'm not going to ask about their ethnicity or their national origin. That's not what happened. He did. And what he said, though, was that in his discretion, at the moment, looking at the climate in the courtroom, having observed what happened at sidebar, which is the reason it's all vested in his discretion, which in Skilling the court recently, Supreme Court accentuated, was really a matter for the district court's discretion, broad discretion, said that, you know, we are not going, I'm not going to highlight this and turn it into something that it's not by now asking each member of the veneer to step over and discuss this. And I would say the time involved in that was a very small piece of that. It was really more, he thought it was going to make a mountain, he was going to cause a problem where there wasn't one.
What was the terrorism gloss in this trial?
I think what Mr. Ackerman is talking about is that a lot of the FBI agents who were on this case were in a terrorism squad. And I'm not sure if it was why on that on the record, why originally that was there. I think there was some suggestion that maybe at some point there was something, but it was nothing that ever came up at trial. And I think the government had taken the position they should be able to say what squad they're on, but Judge Shader ruled, no, that's not relevant. You cannot say that. So I don't believe any of that got in front of the jury.
So the jury did not actually hear that then?
No. That is my recollection from the record. No. And there was evidence, however, that he did send money to Iran through, you know, it was originally a substantive count, was that money had been
Husseini traveled to Iran during the...
He did, during the conspiracy, and there was evidence, and there was originally a substantive count that one of the acts of concealment and avoidance was sending some money to him in Iran through an intermediary and through Canada. That count was struck because it was mispled, it was mischarged, there was an element omitted, so it did not go to the jury. But we were allowed to put on the evidence in the context of the conspiracy charge because it still went to the money laundering conspiracy. So there was, but I would agree with Mr. Ackerman in that in the scope of the case, it was a very small thing. But there was no denial that these defendants were Iranian Americans. I mean, the government is not taking the position that this wasn't something that was before the jury, that they were Iranian Americans, that they own these businesses, but it wasn't suggested they were terrorists or that they were, you know, doing something against the American government. And in any event, bias against Iranian Americans was explored fully in voir dire, and in fact, to show that it was effective, there were a couple of members of the veneer who said I couldn't be fair, and they were excused. Any other of the court? Oh, go ahead.
I have a question about another area.
Oh, yes. Yes.
The counts 10 and 11, the substantive money laundering counts, Husseini's involvement in those. Can you elaborate on your position?
Yes. Yes. So counts the 10 and 11, those are the ones on December 31st where the
His role seems to be just showing up and having a bag of money put in.
Absolutely, positively. And the liability for that is really coming from an aiding and abetting theory, or I think even stronger, the Pinkerton theory.
But
I mean,
you didn't argue the Pinkerton at
Well, we didn't argue it in response. We did argue it in our argument to the jury. I don't think we argued it in defense when they raised a Rule 20, they raised a motion for judgment of acquittal on that count at the close of our case. I think in response to that, for whatever reason, the trial lawyers didn't advocate Pinkerton. But Pinkerton instruction was given, and an argument to the jury, I believe, I can't remember if it was in rebuttal or in closing, we certainly say, you know, he was part of a conspiracy, is my recollection, Your Honor. Rely stronger on my brief on that.
If we were to disagree with you about and vacate counts 4, 10, and 11, would that require resentencing?
I don't think so. Because I say that only because in terms of the amounts of money involved in that, I mean, to get to the ranges and the things that were going on, in general, and the whole idea of money laundering in general, was so massive in this case. We were talking about millions of dollars. The amounts involved in those counts are maybe $50,000. I mean, it's just not much money. And it wouldn't belie the fact that he didn't do those things. It wouldn't belie the fact that he was still involved in this massive money laundering. So as a practical matter, if you're looking at whether those – what Judge Shader said – the reason I say this with confidence is what Judge Shader said in his sentencing of Mr. Husseini is that I'm not going to treat these as little individual counts, every act of structuring, every act of money laundering, because, you know, we could tally this up to be life for him. But I'm looking at this under your RICO charge, because that's your umbrella. And I'm looking at this as part of a whole. And therefore, that's why he sentenced him to 20 years, the maximum for RICO, because he said, I'm looking at this as a global RICO. So based on those statements by him, I think dismissing three individual money laundering counts involving very little money on the basis that he wasn't essentially involved or didn't commit it on those instances don't belie or undermine in any way, shape, or form all the evidence of all the others, which Judge Shader was very clear on the record that this was massive. In terms of how much money laundering was going on here.
I am curious about count four as well.
Oh, count four? Count four, you know, no, I'm not arguing that that's our strongest count, because it certainly is not. However, I think it has to be looked at in the context of all the evidence in this case. And that's saying it differently than you're not treating each count individually.
But in the context of this case, he actually did that one pretty well.
He did not. He wrote the undercover agent clearly wanted his name concealed. I mean, he's portraying himself as a drug dealer. When the defendant starts to write John Russell, he has him switch it to Russell John. He does not list that it was paid for in cash. He does not include a social security number. So by filing an 8300 without a social security number is essentially meaningless. And he's doing this.
It waves a lot of red flags, I think.
Pardon me?
If somebody takes a look at that.
It could, but it wouldn't identify who that person was. It wouldn't lead to them. And if somebody came back and looked at his records on it, it wouldn't lead to them. And he'd be like, I don't know. It didn't include anything. You know, I only met the guy once or twice, and I don't have any more records on him. And, in fact, we don't the record holds that 2 months later the undercover agent comes back, and this time he does file everything, but he writes a false Social Security number. That incident wasn't charged. But but this is also happening in the context of a defendant who is on record saying to the FBI, customers come to me because they want me to conceal this. That's basically how I stay in business. And a defendant who's in the evidence of the case assuring other customers that they will. What I think the best argument for the government in terms of context of the facts in this case and what we essentially argued was that he believed this was drug money. He believed he was laundering it, Mr. Husseini, but he hedged his bets. He hedged his bets that just in case this is an undercover agent, I'm going to file this too. Because the only amount over $10,000 that was ever deposited into the bank accounts and the evidence in this case was that undercover agent's cash. So the evidence viewed in the light most favorable to the government was that he laundered this money, but he did it in a way to hedge his bets, and that was his intent to conceal. If there's no other questions, the government would rest on its brief for the other arguments. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Ackerman? You've got a minute and a half in rebuttal.
Okay. You've got a full courtroom. I won't use it. The court asked specifically whether we believed the individual voir dire was required under the circumstances of this case. We stand by our position. The answer is yes, and that is when individual jurors direct the district court's attention to their bias based on ethnicity, I think it is, but I'm not sure.
We know what you mean.
Okay. Given the overall context, we're at war with these people, not declared, but otherwise. I'd ask only that you consider the separate appendix 115-118 and pages 49 to 51 of our opening brief. If we are correct, and if the court agrees, then trial anew must be granted to both defendants, and thank you so much.
Thank you. Mr. Martin, you have a minute and a half as well.
I'll talk fast. I'm a little confused by the government's argument, because on one hand, I thought I heard him to say that we concede that there should be a resentencing in light of Black, and then on the other hand, when asked about counts 4, 10, and 11, they resisted that. But the authority of this court is that if a substantive count is vacated, then the defendants get another shot at sentencing. That's the case law. With respect to the plain error argument, we cited the South case in our brief that talks about the general motion preserving the issue. Here, while there were specific arguments made, there were also the government did not prove the case beyond a reasonable doubt. So this court would have to do something with South because that's the precedent in this circuit. What we're talking about here is the government's obligation to prove an element of the offense as opposed to an instructional error. This court has looked at the instructions in the Yates context to see what the verdict would hold. But Shkilaba was not an instruction case. Santos was not an instruction case. It's a question of whether the government can prove an essential element with speculation. On the RICO conspiracy issue, I would just note the government's dismissed their cross-appeal, but in Judge Shader's opinion, he did drop a footnote stating that the government did not prove net proceeds on the RICO conspiracy proceeds element. A few things with respect to Husseini. He was not the person who got the bank loan, one of the racketeering activities. That was his co-defendant. He was not the person who was involved with the bribery of Brenda South. She had no dealings with him. Thank you.
Thank you. And our thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement.